You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
The result today is about all of us. It's about our United Kingdom and all our futures. It's not about how anyone voted. Every one of us voted for the best country and the best future. This case was about process, not politics.
Not so fast. On the triggering of Article 50, the UK's High Court rules in favour of the sovereignty of Parliament, to the fury of people who campaigned in favour of the sovereignty of Parliament. My guests Raffaello Pantucci and Ivor Gaber will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the apparent recording of Islamic State's leader rallying the troops defending Mosul. Can they possibly think they can win? And Francois Hollande suggests that the Louvre could become a haven for artworks threatened by war, but how would they get there? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. Now, those who campaigned successfully for the UK to leave the EU on the grounds that they thought British courts and Britain's parliaments should judge and or pass British laws have discovered that taking back control is rather a two-way street, if not a double-edged sword. The High Court has ruled that the government cannot trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, beginning the process of departure without approval from Parliament. This is what Jolyon Maugham QC, barrister who organised the crowdfunding campaign to bring this action to the High Court, had to say earlier.
What denouement could be more appropriate to a campaign about taking back control than a ruling from an English court that, as a matter of English constitutional law, our elected MPs should decide the conditions under which we trigger Article 50. That is what taking back control looks like. It doesn't look like a Prime Minister who was not chosen by the electorate exercising without any parliamentary scrutiny the choice as to what the outcome of the referendum actually means. Of course, the referendum mandates leaving the EU, but it says nothing at all about the trade-off that has to be made between the various competing policy considerations that leaving the EU will require government to make.
Jolyon Maugham QC speaking there, and I for one enjoyed the way he dropped the denouement into the very first sentence there. Theresa May hasn't spoken yet herself directly. A spokesperson for Theresa May has said that this will not disrupt the timetable towards triggering Article 50, but how can it not?
Well, I'm tempted to say she would say that, wouldn't she? Well, I suppose how could it not? I was going to say if the Supreme Court overrules the High Court's judgment. But of course, if they did that, the appellants in the High Court have still got the ability to appeal higher still. So I think it's difficult to see. The court hearing is in December. I think it's very difficult to see how she will not be delayed, but they are talking it up at the moment. The minister responsible, Mr. Davis, is saying we're going to put a short bill through. I think they've got enormous problems, and I think it's rather surprising they hadn't anticipated it.
They do seem to be strangely surprised by it, but then everybody seems to have been strangely surprised by pretty much everything that's happened since June. Raffaello, as Ivor is saying there, the government will, as things stand, appeal to the Supreme Court. What happens if they then lose?
Well,
and there are serious lawyers already suggesting this judgment is pretty appeal-proof as they go.
Well, I mean, I think that the sort of legal struggle will go on. I mean, it's really a reflection of how unpredictable and how unknowable this entire situation was. No one was prepared for this actually to happen. No one was prepared for the vote to actually go Brexit. And so no one prepared for the consequences of that. So the fact that you're seeing legal fights now is merely a sort of reflection of that. We're sort of wandering continually into uncharted waters. And what's really sort of worrying about this whole thing is that no one seems to have any real clue of how this story is actually going to end or when we're we're going to get any sort of resolution. In the meantime, the national economy is sort of slowly slowing down. We're seeing the pound is sort of reaching, I think it's almost at parity with the euro now.
It did jump a bit today, funnily enough, on receipt of this news.
But, you know, it's just the sort of international credibility of this country and its economy is slowly sort of being put on hold, while essentially we're seeing played out a very protracted internal struggle of the Conservative Party on the sort of international stage.
A struggle we have been watching play out now for shortly after the earth cooled. This is not so much a rhetorical question as what this is me asking a question in the hope that you have the answer, because I can't find one anywhere. What is stopping Theresa May now from just, okay, saying, fine, we lost, we won't bother appealing, I will put Article 50 to Parliament now, because she'd win?
Well, eventually. I mean, she would eventually, but if she went to Parliament now, and I've been in Westminster all day talking to people, the judgment is she would be obliged, or the government would be obliged, to put to Parliament, to explain to Parliament the basis of their negotiations. What are you going to ask for?
And given that they've got no idea, that could prove tricky.
It could prove tricky. And they, although Tory MPs who support Remain have been saying, well, the people have spoken, even though we support Remain, we won't block the government. They are saying, just as we thought, we have parliamentary sovereignty. They must explain to us why we should support them. So I don't think a short bill will work for a short time. I think whatever way we cut it, they're in for a delay, unless they win in the Supreme Court.
Raffaello, the Brexiteer tendency, especially the UKIP tendency, so the fairly hardcore Brexiteer tendency, are in predictable paroxysms of fury over this judgment. But isn't this what they wanted all along? Isn't this a British court ruling on behalf of the British Parliament?
Right, but I mean, as Nigel Farage, was quoted today in the Financial Times saying, I worry that a betrayal may be near at hand. I mean, this is a man who didn't even expect to win the referendum in the first place. Called that he'd lost it before they'd actually called the final votes and tallied everything up.
Still quite happily collecting his salary from Brussels as well.
He's still quite happily collecting his salary from Brussels, has stepped back from his party, only to have to step back in as the sort of party goes through some sort of internal ructions. I mean, this is an entire process which is never really that serious. But I think the point that Ivo touched upon, which is the fact that there is no consensus, if the government has to suddenly declare, well, this is our sort of strategy for our negotiation with Brussels, they really haven't developed one yet. You know, I think the Prime Minister was obliged at the last conference to actually offer some sort of a timeline because, you know, they have to put some sort of brake on it because they really don't have any idea what else to do. But they really haven't figured anything out. And in some ways, I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, they see this as a useful opportunity to give themselves a little bit more room and a little bit more time to figure out how they're actually going to resolve this. Otherwise, they've got until March next year, I think, to actually pull the trigger, make the decision and move forwards with a whole strategy in place. And you've been wandering around Westminster today, but certainly in all my conversations over the past few weeks, I've seen very little evidence of a clear and coherent government plan and strategy about what they're actually going to do.
I could give you one, which is not quite Armageddon, but it could be. What would clarify matters is if Mrs. May says, fiddlesticks, or something even stronger, let's put it to the people. Let's have a general election. Labour Party in a complete mess. UKIP having fun. Liberal Democrats still nowhere. They romp home with a huge majority, and the manifesto says we will drive forward Brexit. They're in a very strong position.
But I wonder, an interesting sort of future you could look into in that context is, as you quite correctly pointed out, the Lib Dems and Labour are not really credible opposition at this point. The UKIP seem to be committing suicide slowly as well. So might you not get into an awkward situation where you had an internal ruction within the Conservative Party itself? And so it ended up that not only, you know, you had a sort of contender from within the party deciding that she's not a hard enough Brexiteer, we need a stronger Brexiteer, or on the other side, someone saying, oh, I'm a harder Remainer than she's going to be. If Brexit's sort of the main topic of conversation of the election, and we know that the opposition doesn't exist, could it be that the Conservative Party tear itself apart?
This is exactly what I was wondering about an election from Theresa May's point of view, because this judgment does put both parties in a completely impossible position in terms of an election, because Labour know it'll be a massacre. But Theresa May must be thinking she may return with an increased majority, but it might be an increased majority of hardcore Brexiteer headbangers who will make her life harder than Labour were ever going to.
But you see, Theresa May is, to put it kindly, flexible. possible. She not only was she on the Remain side during the campaign, but in private briefings that the Guardian newspaper got hold of, she was quite clear the damage that Brexit would do. That did not stop her from now appearing to be a pretty hard-line Brexiteer, Andrew. I think she would go with it. She would go with the flow. And she's a politician. She wants to stay in power. I'm afraid her principles seem to be, if you don't like them, I'll change them.
Usually attributed to Sam Goldwyn, wasn't it, that one? If those are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others.
Or, as he also said, include me out.
Raffaello, it is very difficult. Well, we've talked about the difficulties this presents to the government, and it presents the government with huge difficulties. If it's difficulties, it's hard not to find slightly amusing, things being as they are. If you're looking at this from the perspective of the Labour Party, such as it is, how ticking a grenade is this one? Grenades don't really tick. Sorry, that is a. I'm sure there are some that do, but in general, no, they do not. They sort of. We're digressing slightly. but if you'll forgive that metaphor, which is just now
ticking time bomb.
I think that's what I wanted to use. A metaphor that will work. That metaphor has wandered off into the desert to expire alone,
or explode,
or indeed explode. But how does Labour approach this now? Because again, they're kind of constrained. They were nominally Remain, although the leader of the party was none too enthusiastic about it. A lot of their constituencies were very pro-leave. Raffaello, first of all, how do they play this?
Well, I mean, you know, we can see that Jeremy Corbyn today has come forward and said, you know, he wants a Brexit that will work for Britain, and that they will.
Controversial.
I know, very, very controversial here, and you know, and the party will respect the vote that took place in June. I mean, I think if the Labour Party is sensible, they will stand firmly back and let the Tories rip themselves apart in this context, you know, and try to capitalize on that to try to rebuild some sense of the party. I think that the last thing they want to do is get torn into, dragged into this sort of internal conservative spat. If they sort of are patient, I suspect it will just have the effect of sort of ripping the Tory party apart and potentially forcing another election, which I think could be less certain for the Tories, actually, than we necessarily expect. But, you know, I think if they decide to start destroying themselves once again, which they've sort of shown a remarkable proclivity to do in the past sort of few months, then, you know, they might decide to try to chip in and start fighting and start contributing to one side or the other.
Ivor, there is, of course, the middle way, the third way, if you will. And when we talk about the Liberal Democrats, we do have to acknowledge that the three of us plus the people currently in the production booth pretty much outnumber their parliamentary party. But nonetheless, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Tim Farron, has said that the British people voted for a departure, not a destination, which is a reasonable point. 48% of people obviously voted to go nowhere at all, and there are various polls suggesting that number may have increased. Is there mileage, proper mileage, for a third party saying, you know what, referendum be damned, we are the party of Remain?
Well, funny you should mention it, because there's a by-election coming up in West London, in a place called Richmond, where the candidate who's a Tory MP has stood down for another reason.
He's resigned so he can run against himself, as I understand.
Indeed. And he was a Brexiteer. The Liberal Democrats came second last time, and they are campaigning on the basis of, if you want a second referendum, vote Liberal Democrat. I think they would do very well. I won't predict they will win. I think they would do very well. I think for Tim Farron, with his minibus full of MPs, identifying...
I don't know if it's actually quite a minibus full.
It's probably one of those people carriers.
So one of those station wagons with the two seats in
Andrew,
the back.
This is getting as bad as the ticking hand grenade. As I was saying before somebody interrupted me, I think to giving themselves that unique selling proposition, as the marketers put it, identifying themselves as, if you want a second referendum, vote Liberal Democrat, is a shrewd move. They will build on that. They will get, from that 8% they're currently showing, they'll get up to 15, 18%. They could even challenge UKIP and become the third English party.
Raffaello, how does this play into, I guess, the politics on the continent, as it were, about this? Is this going to amplify even more those sentiments, which are fairly understandable, I think, among the 27 other EU countries, which are basically, you're hearing a lot of it now, that sort of like, guys, if you're going, go.
Yeah. No, I think that there's a sense that, you know, the UK has made a decision. You know, I think, look, as I've pointed out before, a lot of politicians that you talk to will say, look, a vote was taken, we live in a democracy, a majority won, and that's kind of it. So the public has made a statement and made a decision, we have to move forward. And I think a lot of people in Europe say that as well. And now they're just waiting for the political forces to kind of get their act together, pull the trigger, do Article 50, and so we can sort of move forwards. I mean, Europe is, I think, desperate for this to happen as rapidly as possible, because the fear is that you're going to start seeing some sort of contagion on the continent. I think none of that has gone away. I think the sort of goodwill maybe that Theresa May could have bought herself in her early days with her attempts at sort of reaching out are very steadily reaching the end of their tether. And I think we're in a context where the Europeans, quite frankly, will eventually get very exhausted and tired and find some way of trying to force the UK to actually trigger Article 50.
They might get tired, but if a contrite UK in a year's time with the economy going belly up and a majority wishing they hadn't voted the way they did, if a contrite UK went to Brussels and said, we've changed our mind, I think they'd be welcomed back with open arms because fear of contagion.
But I think the other side of that equation is that what has been the impact of Brexit on Europe? It has been hugely negative. If we look at sort of, it's not as though Europe has sort of come together. You've ended up foisting this huge point on various European countries where they already had some hesitation. They've already had some sort of the same problems that sort of triggered Brexit here about sort of immigration, about perceptions of immigration amongst some parts of communities, about inequalities, about a sense of a sort of detached elite to a sort of passing legislation which we have no connection with. It's really highlighted a lot of these issues in a lot of countries and, in fact, made them a lot worse to the point that I wonder if, in fact, if in a year or two, time. Yes, the British economy is likely to have suffered, but I have a feeling that the European, continental European economy will have suffered quite substantially as well, to the point that the question would be, why would we want to go back into the club at that point? Because it's no longer the sort of context that we're at before. And now we've had this period where we tried to rebuild relations around the world and sort of re-establish the UK as some sort of free marketeer wandering the world by itself. And I wonder if in that context, actually, and a sort of weakened European context, it won't necessarily even be a place that a contrite UK would necessarily want to go back to.
I did wonder about this at the time during the referendum, that I thought it would genuinely, I speak as someone who voted Remain, but I did think it would have been a genuine.
You had a vote?
I do. I'm a Commonwealth citizen, consonant, resident in this country. But I did actually think that it would have been a very good slogan for the Leave campaign, just to put up on billboards, would you vote to join the EU right now? To which at the time I remember thinking I wasn't sure I had a good answer. But a final thought on this from you, Ivor, and I grant that I am now just pulling stuff out of my head and making it up as I go along, but then so are the people in charge of the country, so I don't see any reason why I shouldn't. Would it calm anybody down or resolve anything if Theresa May announced that after some sort of deal is decided, when we've decided what our negotiating strategy is, once a deal is done with Europe, then yes, there will be another vote? Because what also strikes
another
me...
Another vote? Do you mean another referendum or a parliamentary vote?
One of the two, because what also strikes me as there's the demographic reality which plays into this as well, which, and I do remember reading somewhere quite recently, somebody looking into the fact that older people had tended to vote Leave, younger people had tended to vote Remain. The demographic reality is that every day hundreds of Leave voters are dying and hundreds of Remain voters are coming of age. We may end up in a position when the deal is finally done where it is something the majority doesn't actually want.
You are right, but also, of course, at the same time as they're dying, other people are getting older and joining them, but that's, that's another point. Exactly. To answer your big point, I would put a lot of money against Theresa May or any going for a second referendum. Mm. What I think she is vaguely committed to is putting the terms of the final deal to Parliament, but even there, she hasn't actually pinned herself down saying they would necessarily abide by that parliamentary decision. She said, I will consult Parliament. Well, you know, we consult with a doctor, but it doesn't give us any much power. And I think that she will be very, very reluctant to go to the people again, other than a general election saying, back me or sack me.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Raffaello Pantucci and Ivor Gaber. Coming up next, Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's war cry for the defence of Mosul. More Churchills fight them on the beaches, or more comical Alis, there are no American tanks at Baghdad airport.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's the Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Raffaello Pantucci. Now, in the usual run of things, Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is mercifully silent, often not even bothering to dispute the frequent reports and rumours of his death. He does, however, appear to have piped up as Iraqi, Kurdish and other allied forces bear down upon Mosul, the Iraqi city which IS conquered slightly more than 2 years ago. Baghdadi's statement demanded loyalty from Islamic State's guerrillas in Mosul and fellow travellers abroad, but will they listen? Raffaello, first of all, does this strike you, if it is indeed him, as determination or desperation?
I think what we're seeing here is, in many ways, it's desperation. I mean, this is a leader we hadn't heard from in a very long time. And in some ways, you know, his silence was a reflection of the confidence that he felt about where he was hiding and what he was doing. There's no need for him to kind of be there because everyone knew he was there, everyone knew he was kind of behind the scenes. The fact that you have to make these sorts of statements are very much a rallying cry. And it's to sort of rally the troops who are clearly taking hits and about to lose their second, Iraq's second biggest city, the city which in many ways was the capital of their sort of proto-caliphate. So this is very much the moment he has to start making himself heard. He has to show his troops that he's alive and he's sort of rallying and fighting alongside them, and also send out a sort of declaration. I think one of the interesting things that we heard in this statement that he put out was a very specific threat to Turkey and Saudi as two countries, two Sunni Muslim countries that have been sort of fighting in the coalition against him, which he calls for strikes against, which is actually very strategically sensible. Because if we do start to see large-scale attacks in either of those countries and major instabilities happening there, his group will certainly be able to profit from it.
Ivor, is Baghdadi, not that, you know, one is overwhelmed with sympathy for him, but is he in the has he constrained himself by putting him in the position where any defeat or reversal to him and his project is unsustainable for him? Because he has positioned himself as an almost divine emissary, and if it looks like he's actually getting beaten, it's hard to come back from, isn't it?
No, it's not, because if you're a religious leader, you can ascribe any setback to the will of God or whoever you know.
He'll be like one of those doomsday cultists who leads everybody up the hill and then the lightning strike doesn't come and he says, sorry, I got the wrong week.
And we cannot
look at the watch.
We cannot understand it is not for us to understand the will of the Almighty. What I think is more interesting is why has he chosen at this moment? Because the Iraqi troops and their allies are still a long, long way from taking Mosul. They're still on the outskirts, unless the situation is much worse for ISIL, IS, whatever we call them, than we thought. I'm surprised he's chosen this particular moment, unless, of course, they're worried. There have been reports of desertions. There have been some surprise at the lack of opposition in the approach to Mosul. So maybe he is literally rallying the troops. He is concerned of defections.
I mean, Raffaello, does it at least damage the allure, not just of al-Baghdadi, but of the Islamic State project in terms of attracting finance, of attracting recruits? If it looks like they are getting beaten up, it makes them look a less attractive proposition, doesn't it?
Right, well, people don't like to, you know, waste their lives fighting for losers, right? And you don't want to waste your money that you're giving to sort of advance a cause to a group that is not particularly demonstrating success on the battlefield. You'll instead pour it, your resources or your manpower, into other things. And so, in some ways, I think it is a sort of statement of declaration in that way. What I'd also say is that if we think about the group as an entity which is coming under a lot of pressure on the battlefield and has classically sort of wanted to try to launch attacks outside as a way of showing that, you know, we are still a global force that's able to sort of project all this power and do all these things. It's possible that in some ways this kind of a statement is really directed in that direction. So not only do you rally your troops on the battlefield and show, yes, we're here and we're effective and I'm here, so continue to support and fight for us, but also maybe this sort of a thing will actually start to spark and stimulate something further afield, which would be a benefit and actually start to take some of the pressure off the battlefield. We certainly saw this with Al-Qaeda in the past, that, you know, they would actively try to get some of their regional affiliates to really launch attacks when they were coming under a lot of pressure, quite specifically and strategically, to take the pressure off themselves, because they realize that, you know, there are only so many assets and resources that we pointed towards them. If some of them have to be get diverted somewhere else, well, that means less sort of pressure upon them.
Okay, well, finally tonight, although not on a not unrelated topic, France's President François Hollande has suggested that the Louvre Museum's new conservation facility could serve as a haven for artworks rescued from countries at war. Islamic State, of course, announced themselves to step substantially with a campaign of vandalism directed against the ancient treasures of Iraq and Syria, and they were far from the first such group to regard cultural heritage as a target. Ivor, the question that struck me about this, it's a nice idea, but the first question that struck me is how? Because surely it's going to require a degree of foresight. You need to start shipping these things out of places before the trouble starts.
In an ideal world, you could, there's also, if you like, the deterrent effect. We will recall that the man allegedly responsible for destroying the shrines in Timbuktu has appeared before the International Criminal Court.
The first such sentence, 9 years for cultural destruction.
Indeed.
In Mali, right? Yeah.
In Mali. And it's been classified as a war crime, a crime against humanity. So there is that, even if you can't get the treasures out, you're trying to deter people from doing what they're doing. I mean, there is UNESCO, of which I have more than a passing knowledge, has been trying to build up directories of what's where and trying to take measures to protect them. But of course, UNESCO has no armies. And at the end of the day, as you say, this comes down to a matter of force. But I do think there are some interesting developments. The recreation of some of the lost parts of Palmyra in 3D projection. Is it really? I was wondering myself, because often when you wander around ancient buildings, and then you take your guided tour, you discover a lot of it has been reconstructed.
The old city of Warsaw famously was rebuilt brick by brick after World War II. So yeah, you can end up wondering, what am I actually looking
and
at?
And so does it? And I ask myself the question: whether it's a three
palace
3D,
of Westminster, you could argue, as
it was
well.
Victorian.
Yeah.
So does it matter hugely? I'm getting a sense of what it was like. I'm being a bit blasé here because obviously these are important things, but one has to recognise that there are earthquakes, there are fires, stuff happens.
It does prompt the question, at least it prompts the question to me, Raffaello, is that do we actually get disproportionately upset by the destruction of cultural heritage? Not to say it isn't serious, but the Taliban blowing up the Bamiyan Buddhas attracted far more global attention and condemnation than the obviously worse things they'd done to Afghanistan's actual people.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question and one I've often sort of wondered about. I often think that it gives us something to latch onto about a conflict that feels like it's not actually, it sort of gives us some direct connection. Because at the end of the day, usually in a sort of faraway conflict, there are people dying and you can sort of understand their pain, but still they're on the other side of the world. It's hard to sort of be, it's not very tangible. When instead you talk about things that have been there for centuries and millennia, you're talking more about something which calls to our sort of common cultural heritage. And in that way, it gives you maybe something that you can latch onto in a more comprehensible way, which I've always found is a bit inhuman if you think about it. But at the same time, it's the only sort of logical explanation I'd be able to find around that.
There is, though, something, I suppose, just to wax lyrical, about shared a shared inheritance, civilizations. I'm just currently reading a book about the Silk Roads. And although it's a long...
Peter Frankopan.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I haven't read that one.
Very good book. And there is a sense of universal humanity, if you like. I am sounding lyrical about these shared things. So I was very upset when the Bamiyan statues were destroyed, but I agree. There were many, many thousands of individuals killed as well. But, you know, Man does not live by bread alone.
Ivor Gaber and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippy, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next, 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.